You're listening to Movie Astrology with Matt Hudson and John Burke.
Good morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever you are in the world, and welcome to Movie Astrology. My name is Matt Hudson from What I Watch Tonight, and joining me as ever from across the pond, he's the statesman to my kingsman, John Burke from BurkeReviews.com. How are you, sir?
I am doing quite well, Matt. Ready to return to astrology after a long hiatus.
It seems to be the way. And for those who have been listening from day one or have just jumped on the last episode, we don't ever plan to have a hiatus. We did the last episode, which was, I think, 1985, I think it was, Back to the Future. And then we'd started watching the films for this episode. But then, obviously, a combination of, I think it's just, of COVID, of just stuff got in the way.
Yeah.
But during it, we kept saying, and we've said it on our sister show, the Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast, we said, you know, we're going to do astrology soon. We can't wait to do it. And the other week, we're like, right, let's just sit down and do it. As Palpatine would say. So we never had any... It's funny, isn't it? Because it's not like we sit and think, oh, you know, I can't be bothered to do this. We're both really up for doing it, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. And the hard part, this show sometimes runs a little long. We try to keep it down, but it does. We were recording on Saturdays, and that my wife started having weekends off, so that became harder to do during, like, on a Saturday, because I'm like, well, I really should spend time with my wife, because we're actually off on the same day. And so that's what we've decided to try to just do like we do BAMP. And we'll sacrifice an hour or so on a weekday and make this happen so that we can try to do this. It won't be quite as regular as other podcasts, but we'll do them when we can.
Yeah, we aim for to each other through the looking glass. We say, you know, every 4 to 6 weeks or something along those lines, you know, kind of roughly round about that. And that's what we always aim to do. But sometimes with a year like this or other years, we a lot of our gap list is comprised of these films. So
our earliest, I don't remember what the earliest, like when we first started doing this podcast and we got to one of the early years, we tried doing it without watching the movies, and it was like the hardest thing to ever do, because talk about things you haven't seen?
It was 1960, it wasn't seven, because I think we did dive into that one. It was one of them, wasn't it? 1961, I think it might have been.
It might have, like... But like we learned quickly that like, no, we're going to have to really like do some research in order to make this work. So we've watched a lot of movies, but that takes time. Like we're not always able to do it in a month kind of thing. So like that's part of the reason why we do this as spaced out, because we want to make sure we can bring our experience to the conversation, not just, hey, I heard about this movie.
Yeah. You know that film with that guy in? It's really good. It's the number one film of the year. Yeah, that's exactly it. We want to actually watch the films, absorb them, to be able to talk about them. Even if we're only discussing a certain film for 20 seconds, at least we've seen it and can imprint upon you guys what we think about it. So hence why we've been away for a bit longer than we actually expected. But don't worry, we will be back in our, like John said, our not quite specific release time, but certainly a lot more regular than it has been since June of last year. But I'm glad to hear you're doing well, though, my friend.
Oh, yeah, thank you, sir. You too. I'm glad it's safe over there in the UK right now. But, you know, the world's a scary place in general, and there's no escaping it, apparently.
Yeah, no, the world sucks at the minute. And that's why sometimes jumping back into a few years past can make things seem a little nicer, as long as that year in particular has been pretty good. And for those new to the show, John and myself, we take a year that is randomly selected by us using a random generator algorithm, and we discuss it in full. We talk about the top 10, the major films that came out, and more that you'll hear during the episode. And this year, John, what year are we talking about?
We're talking about 1963.
Yes, 1963. So a lot of these films were on our gap lifts, and we've gone and covered as many as we can do for you. So before we get to talk about the films, though, let's find out what went down in the world in 1963.
In history.
I'm going to butcher this right out of the gate. Tetsuan Atomu, Astro Boy, Japan's first serialized animated series based on the popular manga is broadcast for the first time on the Japanese television station Fuji Television.
Nice one. Leonardo da Vinci's Mona Lisa is exhibited in the United States for the first time at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C.
The publication of Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique launches the reawakening of the women's movement in the United States as women's organizations and consciousness-raising groups spread.
The Alcatraz Federal Penitentiary on Alcatraz Island in San Francisco Bay closes.
The Beatles release their first album, Please Please Me, in the United Kingdom.
Buddy Rogers becomes the first WWWF champion.
The Coca-Cola Company introduces its first diet drink, Tab Cola.
I did like a tab. The freewheeling Bob Dylan is singer-songwriter Bob Dylan's second studio album and most influential, opening with the song Blowing in the Wind, released by Columbia Records in the States.
And I can't start a tab unless you order something. President John F. Kennedy broadcasts a historic civil rights address in which he promises a civil rights bill and asks for the kind of equality of treatment that we would want for ourselves.
Well, flex. Valentina Tereshkova, the first woman in space, returns to Earth, landing in the Soviet Union.
And John F. Kennedy gives his Ich bin in Berliner, I totally butchered that, speech in the West Berlin, Germany. In my head, I said it right, and then as soon as it came out of my mouth, I'm like, nope, that's wrong.
Nope, it's out there in the world now. Zip codes are introduced in the United States Postal Service.
The Great Train Robbery takes place in Buckinghamshire, England.
Martin Luther King Jr. delivers his I Have a Dream speech on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial to an audience of at least 250,000 during a march on Washington for jobs and freedom. It is, at that point, the largest single protest in American history.
Sam Cooke and his band are arrested after trying to register at a whites-only motel in Louisiana. In the months following, he records the song A Change Is Gonna Come.
The car manufacturing firm Lamborghini is founded in Italy.
Malcolm X makes his historic Message to the Grassroots speech in Detroit, Michigan.
On November 22nd, in a motorcade in Dallas, Texas, U.S. President John F. Kennedy is fatally shot by Lee Harvey Oswald. Hours later, Lyndon Johnson is sworn in aboard Air Force One.
On November 24th, Lee Harvey Oswald is shot dead by Jack Ruby in Dallas, an event seen on live national television.
Wendell Scott becomes the first African-American driver to win a NASCAR race at Speedway Park.
Marvel releases their superhero assembly team, The Avengers. You might have heard of them.
Well, I have. Jose Mourinho, Eva Cassidy, Michael Jordan, Seal, Charles Barkley, Rick Rubin, Jimmy Osmond, Conan O'Brien, Russell T. Davis, Coolio, James Hetfield, Whitney Houston, Tori Amos, jeez, Jarvis Cocker, Mark McGuire, and Johnny Marr are all born this year.
And Sylvia Plath, Patsy Cline, Aldous Huxley, and Dinah Washington all passed away this year.
It's also the year that Beatlemania hit the UK and the US. Please Please Me came out, and that started the world's love affair with the four guys from Liverpool. So 1963, some monumental moments in history. Yeah. I Have a Dream, JFK's assassination, and the subsequent fallout from that. Some people coming into the world and leaving with big reputations and legacies as well. So it's a big year in terms of what happened around the world. And in terms of that JFK assassination, I'm pretty sure in one of our next few episodes, we'll be covering the film JFK and maybe looking into that a little bit more. So a big year for the world in 1963. So now, John, let's get to what we're here for. Let's find out what the top 10 was from 1963.
Top 10.
So here we're going to go from 10 to 4. Kind of rapid fire. This is ranking based on the worldwide gross, which is still true, right? Even though, because this is older, maybe
it should
domestic
be domestic gross.
Gross,
I think. Sorry, this is domestic back gross. In the old days. The old days.
We don't have those numbers like we do now. But we go from 10 to 1. And once we get to 3, 2, 1, we'll stop and kind of slow down a bit, but we'll just kind of rapid fire these off to start. Matt, what was number 10?
Number 10, then, 1963, the 10th biggest film of the year was The Great Escape, which brought in a total of $5.546 million domestically.
And then number 9 was a tie. This is an uncharacteristic tie. We have Move Over, Darling, and Come Blow Your Horn, which I hate the name of that movie so much, both with 6 million on the dot, apparently.
John's certainly not blowing their horn. Number 8 was Bye Bye Birdie, which made 6.2 million.
Number 7, Charade, or Charade, if you prefer, 6,363,000.
Number 6, Son of Flubber, which came in at 9.1 million.
Number 5, Irma La Douce, 11,900,000. So a big jump there, but not as big as the next.
No, number 4, Tom Jones, which grossed 17.070 million domestically. So, yeah, some films there you may have heard of, some you may not have heard of, but don't worry, guys, we got you covered. John, what have you seen then from 10 to 4?
So I have caught The Great Escape. All of these I had not seen prior to prepping for this episode, mind you. So, like, they had some had been on my list. The Great Escape was one that had been just so aware of. I watched Come Blow Your Horn, yep. Which was one of the first Frank Sinatra films that I've seen, I think, with him in the lead. That is Sinatra, right? I'm not screwing
it. It is Sinatra, yeah.
I am correct. And then I caught Bye Bye Birdie, which I was like, hey, is this about Elvis? And it was. It was originally supposed to be Elvis. Charade had been on my long list for a while because Cary Grant, Aubrey Hepburn, and Audrey Hepburn, and there's a remake. Well, yes, Math Isle's amazing, but there's a remake. I think it's What to Do About Charlie or something with Mark Wahlberg and Zoe Saldana.
Oh yeah, there is, yeah.
And so, like, that had come up on a, I think, Blank Check episode. So, like, I was, like, very intrigued by the whole thing. So I own both of those. And I haven't watched the remake because I've heard it's terrible. But I wanted to catch Charade. And then Irma La Douce, which Billy Wilder, Jack Lemmon, Shirley MacLaine. Wow. That movie was one I had not really heard of before. And I really, really liked that movie a lot. Of the ones I just listed, I actually think that was one I had the most fun with. Great Escape is epic, but it's also like, man, does it beat you down? Like it you're just like, oh no. this movie so much. It's so overwhelming. Which is, of course, I mean, it's a like the premise. Also, to be fair though, I also keep thinking The Great Escape, I'm assuming, is just a prison movie, but it's not, because it's the Nazis prison movie, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's, yeah, like, there's that whole other layer. You're like, oh, this is so much worse. Like, it was bad with a prison break, but it's like the people running the prison are Nazis, so it's real bad. Like, it's not an enjoyable experience in that way. But there is some weird levity in it at times. But then, yeah, it gets real serious. But an excellent movie. I actually like Charade quite a bit too, though. But it's Cary Grant and Audrey Hepburn, who I'm a big fan of both. At this point. So what have you seen on this list?
I managed to catch the ones that you hadn't seen. So we've got a lovely yin yang balance. I've seen The Great Escape many times because it's played over here in the United Kingdom a lot over the Christmas period. It's synonymous with Christmas over here. And the Great Escape theme, the very famous theme by, I think it's Elmer Bernstein, is played so much, especially at the England national team games, which is slightly odd when you think about where it came from. But you know, I like The Great Escape. I think it's a very good film. I know what you mean, though. For me, it's, you know, it doesn't take, for me, it's a kind of, it doesn't focus as much on the war. You know, it's not quite as harrowing as other war films, but you've still got that hanging over you, the fact that this is a true story. And, you know, the Nazis, whilst this film is kind of having a more slightly lighthearted look at it compared to how it probably could have been, you still have that overhanging kind of the black cloud of World War II and what the Nazis were all about. And I'm pretty sure in real life, I don't know if Steve McQueen's character did actually do that badass jump over the fence, but in the film, though, it's Steve McQueen, and you know damn well he asked, I'm doing that. So I watched Move Over, Darling, which was fine. You know, it's whimsical. It's a comedy, romantic comedy, for those who don't know, in the it's really daft. In the film, James Garner is married to Doris Day. She's presumed dead, so he marries Polly Bergen, and just as he marries Polly Bergen's character, Doris Day reappears on the scene. She was just stranding on a desert island for 5 years. So now he's got two wives, and of course he's going on his honeymoon. Doris Day kind of goes there to get him back, and then it's to kind of hijinks of James Garner trying to placate both of his wives, and it all gets very daft, but it's far-fetched as hell, but it was fun. There were some fun moments. It's all the jokes are above board. Even the kind of bedroom gags were all above board. You know, there's nothing too naughty in there. Doris Day's very good, and James Garner was very good as well. So I also watched Charade. I thought it was pretty good. I've heard the comparisons to Hitchcock, and it is Hitchcockian. It might be a bit more jaunty than Hitchcock's normal
film. It's almost like a comedic parody of a Hitchcock film in a lot of ways.
Yeah, because there's that tension there, but it's undercut by the fact that Cary Grant seems to be having a bit of fun in the film. And I thought Hepburn is great, especially as she's struggling with, you know, who to trust and her own doubt. Paris looks very good. For those watching in black and white, this one's in Technicolor. Looks very nice. The story gets a bit muddy and a bit messy, but you know, I thought Charade was a very good. And like you, I'd heard of it. I'd been wanting to watch it, and I'm so glad I actually got to watch it. And we get that great line. Do you know what's wrong with you? Nothing. You know, really nice, cool line. Son of Flubber. Watch that. Bit naff. Not really very funny or exciting. It's a very run of the mill sequel. If you like the first film, then this one's very much the same. It's not really much to it. I too watched Irma LaDuce. I thought, like you, actually, I'd heard of it because of its title. I assumed it was a Federico Fellini Italian film. I didn't realise that it's clearly French, but it's set in Paris, isn't it? But I was in the whole time. You know, it might have been a bit long, but I was in. You know, I had fun with it. It's I had some moments in it where I actually proper laughed during it.
Yes,
it felt like a stage show because it was a stage show originally. And it felt also, but it had like a musical feel to it. But I thought they were really good. I thought they were very good. I thought the two leads in it, Jack Lemmon was great, even when he had to put on that kind of really odd British Lord gag. But and Shirley MacLaine was very good too. And it's Billy Wilder, isn't it? So Billy Wilder is a legendary director for a reason. And I also watched Tom Jones. This was the one I was like, actually, there's a few on this list where I looked at and thought, oh man, I've got, you know, this might be a bit of a struggle. And I'd heard that Tom Jones was a very good film, and I watched it, I sat through it, and I wasn't taken by Tom Jones. It's very theatrical, very vaudeville as well. And it's also jaunty. It's like a lot of these films in the top 10. I found it quite boring. It's a comedy, but I didn't find it very funny. It's a kind of quirky comedy, and it just didn't work for me. It's too long. Albert Finney's great. Albert Finney's very committed in his role, but basically the film comes down to can Tom Jones smarm, charm and sleep his way out of trouble. That's basically, he's very unlikable, and I wasn't taken by Tom Jones as much as the world seems to be. So Charade, Irma LaDuce, I thought were good films, and The Great Escape's good, and Move Over Darling was a fun way to spend an hour and 45 minutes.
Yeah. I can't think, I'm trying to remember there was a movie I saw, like a recent film that I felt like was definitely inspired by Irma LaDuce. Like it was a depiction of France, and like some of the, I felt like the apartment was in, maybe it wasn't a recent film. I'm like driving myself nuts because I remember watching it going, this reminds me of that movie. And like, it's very likely because obviously it's a famous movie, but
I know it's not the film, but the first film I think of with any kind of French feel is, of course, Amelie, which is,
oh yeah, no, not at all.
That's just stunning. You know, it's that straight away.
I'm thinking it might've been an older film that maybe looked like they used the same set. And that's what like, I don't know. I'm like scrolling through my Letterboxd diary. Like, come on, what was it?
Well, Irma LaDuce. I've been to Paris. I've been. I love that city. Irma LaDuce. I was like, this could look any less like Paris if they tried. Whereas Charade very much feels like Paris. It was interesting that obviously in these decades, like the 60s, you have a lot of crossover where in this top 10 and in other films, you see the same names crop up quite a lot, and it's just fun to see that at least two of these films were set in Paris this year in the top 10. I think that there's only two. Yes, there is, but still you get that. It's interesting to see the crossover between these earlier decades.
Yeah. for sure. I really like to see the influence of films on other films, because I always find that super interesting. I wish I could remember what I thought it was, because I couldn't. I was like, I Googled it and I was trying to find like someone else making that observation, and I could not for the life of me find it.
You could be the only one who's made it, dude.
That, and it's definitely possible, because I mean, you have to have seen both movies, and there's a good chance maybe you haven't. And again, I can't remember what that other movie was, but nevertheless, that's our 4 through 10. Some of these were not easy to get, or you had to purchase to watch. They weren't all readily available. That's part of the struggle with some of these later years, or I guess earlier years, that we can't easily get them unless you're willing to invest in them. Like, you got to either buy like the Criterion Blu-ray, or you got to pay like the $10 or $15 to buy it on digital. Sometimes outrageously priced. And every once in a while we get lucky and it's like on HBO Max or it's on Prime.
Yeah. But, or you can rent it sometimes for $2 maybe. Sometimes I don't, usually if I can buy, I'll buy. But when it comes to the unknown, sometimes I don't mind paying £2.49 to rent the film. Cause if I don't like it, okay, I've lost $2.50, but I haven't got it sitting on my shelf for eternity.
I'm going to put this out to the ether, companies like Vudu and iTunes. When iTunes Music was like a thing, when we were actually buying CDs digitally back in the day, if you bought a song from an album, they would reduce the price of the album based on the number of songs you would purchase.
Yeah, yeah.
And I love that, because I could buy the song I wanted, and if later I'm like, you know what, I just want the whole album, they didn't make me pay for that song again.
Yeah.
So to me, if you rent a movie, at the end of the rental, it should pop up with the option to buy at a discounted price minus
based
the rental.
Based on the price of the rental, yeah.
And because, like, I hate renting a movie that I might love and then want to own. You know what I'm saying?
Like, almost feel like you're paying twice for it then.
Right. So I'm putting this out in the ether, companies. Give me that. Because, again, you're not losing any money, because I'll tell you from my experience, if I have rented something, very rarely will I immediately buy it. I might buy it once it comes on sale,
yeah,
then there's that difference of price anyways. But if I've paid $3 and I'm like, this movie was amazing, and at the end it's like, own it now for seven more, I'm probably going to click that button.
I agree, because if I go to buy it and it's £16 or $20 for our American friends, do you know what? The first thing I can think of is, you know what, I will probably just go to the local store, the CEX or what dollar store, whatever you want to call it, And I'll pay that store, and they get to keep the money, you know. And
yeah,
you know, the studio then misses out, because I'll pay £5 instead, which is, you know, for me a bargain, because I get the film I like and I pay less. Brilliant. But then you know, the studios are going to miss out on their much needed money because they've priced themselves out of the market.
So with that in mind, this is our top three.
Let's do it.
Number three, it's a mad world. I hope that's the right number. United Artists, distributed, directed by Stanley Kramer. This movie has a huge cast. It stars Spencer Tracy, Milton Berle, Sid Caesar, Buddy Hackett, Ethel Merman, Mickey Rooney, Dick Shawn, Phil Silvers, Terry Thomas. There's a hyphen in that name. Jonathan Winters, Edie Adams, Dorothy Provine, and Jimmy Durante. Made $20 million. Back in 63, which is pretty big. That feels like a lot of money. This is one of those movies that I'd heard about. It's got such a weird title, it's impossible to not like have heard reference to it. I'm trying to remember. It's been a while since I've watched these movies. That's the other problem with we prepped and then we couldn't record. So like, I've watched a lot of these back in like August, September. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I watched this in May of 2021.
Jesus.
So it's been almost a year since I watched this movie.
How's your memory?
Not great. I don't remember much. And that's the thing. I remember a lot about a lot of movies. This particular movie, not much, because it's so wild. And they're like, you're jumping. I think the modern day kind of equivalent would be the Amazing Race movie, right?
Yeah.
Which I've never seen, but I have a lot of friends who love, or whatever it was called. It was something race. The Amazing Race is a TV show, but it's the same idea, right? There's like a race. They're trying to get to something. I think, I don't remember. I know I gave it 3 stars, so it was engaging, but also not engaging. It's a group of strangers come across a man dying after a car crash. He proceeds to tell them about the $350,000 he buried in California. Yeah. Didn't love it. It's real long. It's really freaking long.
Dude.
Like, it's 163 minutes. I'm like, okay, this doesn't need to be this long, right? Like, it could be like an hour and a half. Like, how much of the race do we need? And some of the characters are real obnoxious. There is some humor in it. Not all of the humor ages well. But yeah, I am glad to have checked that one off the list, I think.
Well, the trend in the earlier years of film, especially this one, where a lot of the films are very long. Now, the editors may be there on a 24-hour lunch break. I don't know when it came to that, but I'm looking at the influences for this film, and Scavenger Hunt, Million Dollar Mystery, and Rat Race are named as films that have been influenced by this film. See, I didn't catch this film. I haven't seen this one, but Spencer Tracy, he's popped up in a couple of films already. He's already got one more to mention. Terry Dash Thomas, that's his name. Literally, his name is Terry - Thomas, which is really odd. So, I'm not surprised you got flummoxed by that one. But I mean,
yeah, I was thinking it was like a last name. I'm like, wait, where's the other? There's a name. Yeah,
I know. I had to double check it, but his name is down as Terry. His name was Terry Thomas Terry Hoare Stevens. So for some reason, he took the first two names, flipped them, and put a hyphen in. So I don't know. Maybe that was part of the joke. I don't know. But what I know about this film is that it is fairly well received, and the AFI have it is number 40 in their 100 years, 100 laughs list. So do you remember it being, you know, particularly funny? Or, I know you said some of the jokes are outdated, but.
I mean, I like parts of it. I do remember a few things. It's part of the problem is because it is so long and there are so many characters that it's like, I remember more flashes than anything specific. Like I remember, and they're driving. So it's a lot of like, you know, and they do a lot of the zany, like somehow this group ends up in this other group's car because this is happening. And like, there's a little bit of like blackmail and betrayal happening throughout. Yeah, I mean, I vaguely remember thinking it was funny at times, but at the end of it, I was like, yeah, that was felt a little more like a chore. I did click that I liked it on Letterboxd, so I definitely, it must have worked more than it didn't, but at the same time, it definitely felt real long, like real, real long.
I think the film's mostly, partly, as well, for the credit, opening credits by Saul Bass, which are in his famous style as well, so I know that from doing research that came up an awful lot. So $20 million in 1963 now roughly equates to, I've used an inflation calculator, now roughly equates to just under $184 million this film made.
Not bad for a studio comedy.
Not bad whatsoever. So it's a mad world, however many mads are in there. That was number three. So John, number two in 1963 is a very famous film, How the West Was Won, an MGM film. This has three credited directors, Henry Hathaway, John Ford, and George Marshall. There is also another uncredited director who did some transitional scenes in between the five chapters, of whose name I haven't been able to locate as of yet. But this film, not a huge jump, though. The last one made just over $20 million. This made $20.9 million domestically. Rotten Tomatoes gives it 86% overall, with Metacritic a 56, which surprised me because most of the things I've heard about How the West Was Won were, you know, glowing praise and it was fabulous. So to see that 56 surprised me. And I watched this film again. This film is nigh on 3 hours long, 2 hours 45, I think it is. It begins with an almost 5 minute long overture, and then has an intermission in the middle, which was, you know, they keep them in, which is, that's quite quaint. I quite like that. The version I saw was the restored version, which looked stunning. It looked visually stunning. It genuinely did look so good. But you still get the overture and you still get the intermission as if you're in the theaters back in the '60s. This was shot on Cinerama back in the day. So they had an awful lot of problem trying to adapt the three camera approach down to one on a flat screen, and it took them until the last decade to really restore this properly. But yeah, there's five chapters. John Ford directs one, it's called The Civil War. George Marshall directs The Railroad, and Henry Hathaway directs three: The Rivers, The Plains, and The Outlaws. There's no Sam Elliott, which is a shame because I assumed, as per his comments, that he was in every Western ever made, despite being from Sacramento. It opens with a really beautiful shot. You know, they're flying through the clouds and the mountains. What this film and the next film have in common is they took their budget and they went big. They spent their money on the visuals. They went big. How the West Was Won is a beautiful looking film. There's lots of dames who need a man. In fact, one of the quotes is, "I don't need money, I need a man," from one of the characters, which is odd. But what was it like? It's a good film. How the West Has Won, I think this is a good collection of films. It follows, I think it's the Prescott family. They are the narrative thread throughout all five stories, which cover 50 years, I think. It's 1830 to 1880. And you have battles, you have Native Americans, you've got buffalo stampedes, you've got, you know, every kind of Western trope you can imagine is in there. Obviously, the cast of this is fantastic. The cast of this is is huge. Just to name a few, of course, you've got John Wayne in there. Lee J. Cobb, Gregory Peck, Carl Malden, Debbie Reynolds, Carolyn Jones, Henry Fonda, Eli Wallach, James Stewart. There's such a huge, huge cast in this. And everybody gets their kind of moments here and there. But I think this film was a good film. I think my favourite was the John Ford short or anthology piece, which was called The Civil War, which actually had John Wayne in it. That felt very accomplished. It felt very confident, that filmmaking did. But I thought Howard West's one was a very good film. I can see why it's so highly rated and held in high esteem. It looks great. It sounds great. And, you know, it's a very long film. So some people might say, oh, these boomers and these millennials or whatever, sorry, can't handle a long film. We can. But
yeah,
there are times in these longer films where not an awful lot happens and the pacing is pedestrian. And you get that quite a bit in Howard West's one. But
I mean,
I didn't. I liked it.
The last 6 months, not even 6 months, but The Batman is 2 hours 55 minutes, and Drive My Car is like at 3 hours. Loved both of those movies. And I feel like neither of those really have any wasted space. Even though they're long, I don't feel like they're wasting the time. Like, it doesn't feel like there's stuff
4 hours long.
Yeah, and I think there was a little bit of room to trim some of that in the Snyder Cut, but nevertheless, like, I still didn't dislike that. It's not the length itself that is the issue, although I will say that will stop me from watching something. Like, if I'm like, I have to commit to 4 hours, I don't have the time for that.
It's not the size, it's what you do with it.
Yeah. Now, that said, the length of the next movie did stop me from watching it. And also, again, I think both How the West Was Won and Cleopatra required me to buy it. I actually do have How the West Was Won. I just never got to it. And then, like, I kept putting it off because it was so long. I am going to end up watching that movie because it's one on the list. John Ford is a director whose stuff, especially because he's part of the Five Came Back crew, that I feel obligated to watch their content for historical context. So I will go to this. But the number one movie, which is crazy because it's a movie that's often forgotten, but Cleopatra. It's 20th Century Fox. Joseph L. Mankiewicz directs. Huge cast: Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton, Rex Harrison, Roddy McDowall, Martin Landau, Hume Cronin, George Cole. Doesn't quite make its budget. This is one of those movies that is more infamous for its failure than it is for its successes. Had made $26 million, but had a roughly $31 million budget. So huge loss for the studio.
$285 million budgets in 2022.
Wow, the inflation. I was like, whoa, I'm reading the number, man. What did I do?
In 2022. Yeah, it's definitely inflated, but that's huge.
Yeah, huge. And, you know, critically, it's not panned, but it's not loved either, which I think is usually if you're going to have a flop, you at least want, like, well, people just didn't get it. And that doesn't seem to be the general consensus. It's just more like, no, they just went a little bloated. I've read some things about it. I've never seen it, but Matt, you did sit down for this movie, which runs at, I think I saw 246 minutes. Is that right?
251 minutes, John. Come on.
Ah, okay. Sorry.
Give me credit here.
Yeah. Quite the long epic.
Yes.
Did you watch this in chunks or all in one sitting?
I watched it all in one sitting. Well, in one sitting, but in chunks because, you know, man, you know, hungry dog's got to eat. I've got to go and eat. I've got to go to the bathroom. There were times when I was like, right, I need to have 10:50. I needed to have that intermission or an interlude and, you know, go and make a cup of tea or just check my phone or, and that's a lot of, some people might listen to think that's bad form. But this is 4.5 hours long, or was it? It was 61, 21, 8, yeah, 4 hours long. And it's on Disney Plus as well, which was very helpful. Disney Plus came to my aid there. I'd heard many things about this film, how it damn near bankrupted 20th Century Fox, and it was kind of well received when it came out, and some people also weren't so keen on it. But, you know, I was interested to watch it, but I was absolutely, I'm not going to lie, dude, I don't care if it's a Star Wars film, a superhero film, a period drama, historical film. 4 and a bit hours is a long, long time, and that is going to weigh on your mind. So going in, I was like, this is going to be, I know this is going to drag in parts. And it does. Cleopatra isn't a bad film, actually. Cleopatra's fine, but in chunks. You know, I mean, if you take the best moments of this film and somehow squeeze them into one like tight narrative, you've got a really good film here. There are some really good moments in here, especially, well, Elizabeth Taylor is Cleopatra. Now, of course, Elizabeth Taylor isn't Egyptian. So there's that. But 20th Century Fox needed a star to sell this film and make their money back. So they got Elizabeth Taylor and her on-off man, Richard Burton, her beau, and Rex Harrison in, amongst many others, to sell this. And she's fantastic with as Cleopatra. I think she's really good. She exudes power and sultriness and sexuality to her performance. She's very good. Richard Burton as well is good. Rex Harrison as Caesar is good as well. Performances, very good. Visually, again, this film, they got a huge budget. This and How the West Was Won are by far and away the biggest budgets of the lot. And Cleopatra shows. The most famous scene is, you know, when Cleopatra enters Rome, and you come and I'm watching this in 2021, whenever it was I watched it, and I'm almost blown away by this scene. It's like, this is all practical. They've got a massive moving like sphinx with Cleopatra on it, and she's being carried on a litter whilst on it. You've got thousands of extras on this huge location. And I'm thinking, you know, nowadays, when we get work, because we're going to get that Patty Jenkins, Gal Gadot, Cleopatra, all of that is CGI'd. All of it is CGI'd, all done on the volume, and they have a few extras. Here, they couldn't do that. They put their budget where their mouth is, and they really went to town. I think I read there's like 12,000 extras or something like that. They really went for this. The production design is great. The music is good as well, but it just drags far too much for me. And that isn't a modern day film fan complaining, but it generally does. There are moments where, you know, the camera will just linger. It's the same in How the West Was Won, to be fair, where the camera will just linger, and or the shots will be static. The shots aren't interesting enough to really keep you engaged. It's a static shot, and people aren't really moving throughout. The mise-en-scene is great, but what's happening with the characters, not so much. So Cleopatra, I think, I would say it's well worth anyone's time for a first-time watch. I will say that, because I went in expecting this film to be a car crash based on what I've heard, and it really isn't. It's not a bad film at all. It is just very, very long. The performances are good. It looks great. But, it's 4.5 hours, and that's the thing that I keep hanging my hat on, because that doesn't need to be that long. It doesn't need to be that long. It is, and it suffers because of it. I think this film is much better if it's shorter. And I genuinely mean that. Some films demand a long runtime. Some films need it. I don't think this one does, and I think it suffers because of it. But there are still many good positives. And yeah, that and there's a scene with Cleopatra with Mark Anthony where she basically says, you know, kneel to me. And the way she says it, the power in her voice is really, really, really really good, really affecting. So Cleopatra is a good film, but the fact that it almost put the studio out of business, probably Warren said it should have made more money.
Yeah. And of course, when there is a flop like this on this scale, it always makes studios apprehensive to doing these type of adventurous projects, and that sometimes is bad. Like, we want movies to get made, and if studios are afraid to make something ambitious, it's like,
and this is
like, the one of the things about the Wachowskis that are so impressive is they keep getting to make big budget movies despite them almost always flopping financially. That's a fear that I've, every time they make one, I'm like, please let them make one more. Like, cause I enjoy their movies, even the weird ones, like Jupiter Ascending, but, I like that they get to make them, and I don't want that to stop. It's the same thing. Like M. Night Shyamalan had hit that wall where they weren't letting him make movies anymore, and he just did it himself. Like, he used his own money to make The Visit and got out of director jail, but old might put him back in director's jail, although he is making something else now. But still, like, I am always afraid, because I want movies to get made. Even if they don't all work for me, I want them to exist for someone. Someone will enjoy this, like, somewhere, right? Like, at least most of
sure.
Not always.
Oh, yeah, for so, sure. And this and How the West Was Won, they're both very ambitious films, obviously, with the cast that they've assembled. but with the budget they've used and with the, I mean, How the West Was Won really kind of put his neck out for the Cinerama, you know, and that caused a lot of problems on set because the directors hated it, the actors hated it because they couldn't look at each other in a scene because at the Cinerama, for those who don't know, it's three cameras filming at once on different angles and it's designed to be projected on a curved screen. So, of course, if the actors are standing next to each other looking at each other, then that's not going to play well on a curved screen. So they're having to look past each other, which affects their performance because they're not looking at what they should be looking at. And it's, you know, the directors hated it and it caused a lot of trouble with the restoration. From what I've seen on those curved screens from archive footage, it looks amazing. Like it's almost, it's like a precursor to IMAX almost, but
yeah,
it didn't go down well. But, and again, lots of static shots because there's only so much they could do and they have so much camera to fill. They reframe to fill that they, a lot of shots can be uninteresting at times. But yeah, I totally agree with you there, my friend. Nobody can say anything about the first two films other than they are extremely ambitious films. They really went for it. And Cleopatra, the scale of it is vast. And for 1963, it's an incredible achievement of filmmaking. But it's just too long for me, my friend. But it's an interesting top 10. I think The Great Escape is probably the most parodied film on that list for me. I think you watch so many films now, and having seen The Great Escape, it's like, oh, that's where that came from. But so before we move on, top 10, quick thoughts then, my friend. What are you thinking from the films that you saw and what you've heard?
It's in some ways a lackluster year as far as the top 10, because some of these movies I think have kind of been forgotten to a degree. I think they were still pretty solid. Some good humor in a few of them. Cause even, Come Blow Your Horn, a title again, I hate saying, there's some solid humor in there, but I actually really like Sinatra's character story as he kind of learns to mature, in a way that was unexpected. Obviously, like you said, Great Escape is of the top 10, I think is the most influential of these films. But Cleopatra, I'm wondering if Hail Caesar, if the movie they're making is supposed to kind of be referring to that, because it is like it's over budget and they're worried that it's too epic. And I'm like, is that obviously Cleopatra wasn't the only epic that bankrupted studios, but it's one that's pretty infamously, because like Citizen Kane took out RKO almost.
Yeah.
But Citizen Kane has come to be one of the most important movies of all time, where Cleopatra has not done that. Like, it's not a movie that's often thrown into the pan of like, oh, well, it just was ahead of its time. It's like, no, you don't really hear people. Like you're saying, it's not a bad movie, but it's not, like, considering what it almost caused, it wasn't apparently worth it, because you didn't get that life-changing or movie-changing film that you did from, like, Citizen Kane or whatever. So I think on this list, for sure, How the West Was Won, title-wise, it's a movie that I constantly am aware of, but also feels like a lot of people haven't seen, but it's just one that people are aware of. Mm-hmm. I think it almost feels like this proto-Western. Like, it's not. It's obviously very late in the Western genre, but I think just the title of it just has so much impact of, like, How the West Was Won. It's like, even if you haven't seen it, it's a movie you're aware of.
Yeah.
And then It's a Mad, 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 Mad World is just like a title where you're like, is that the actual title? Did someone fall asleep on the keyboard? What's
someone
going on?
Sign that off, man.
Yeah. But, I think there's some good movies on this list. I don't have an issue with the order. Like, there's like, sometimes we do this and we're like, how did that make so much money? It kind of makes sense that even though Cleopatra still lost money, it still makes sense that it made the most, because people definitely were like aware. Like, you could tell there was probably a huge marketing thing. I could see theaters having big Egyptian stuff outside of those theaters to try to promote it. Like, interesting top 10 to say the least.
Yeah. I mean, you've got the biggest films of the year are the two most epic films of the year, which, you know, sometimes is the case nowadays, it's reflected now. The only one I would say, I agree with what you've just said there, my friend. The only thing I would say is, looking at it, I would have thought The Great Escape could have been a little bit higher, but this is the 60s was a different time. You know, studio comedies were much more of a thing. There were, I'll say, a dozen more, but they were the prominent genre, as far as I'm aware, as you can see by the fact that you've got so many in the top 10.
Yeah. And at the time, it's, we see in our news of the year, it's a tough time. The civil rights movement is in full swing. People are still recovering from World War II, and like, they're just not, like, people want to go to the theater for escapism at a height, and so, yeah, you see that. And you see that kind of now with reflected in we prefer superhero movies to the indie dramas as far as the mainstream audience goes.
Yeah, so a mixed top 10. Nothing that's really, I don't think there's anything that's really awful apart from some of Son of Flubber wasn't great, but for the most part, you know, pretty good top 10. Now let's move on to find out what else was released in the year of 1963.
Notable releases.
Yes, sir, Jonathan Burke. The rest of the films, the best of the rest, or sometimes the worst of the rest, or the good, the bad, and the ugly of the year, so of 1963. And we say this quite a lot. I think regular listeners will hear us say this, but sometimes this notable releases section has films that are either culturally more significant or ones which we, in hindsight, think, how was that not in the top 10? Because they're either, you know, for us, subjectively better, or they've become, like you said, with Citizen Kane, and they've become something more. And so some of the films I've been checking out on this list, I watched Lilies of the Field, the Sidney Poitier comedy. Sidney Poitier, he was an actor who I hadn't seen enough of his films. And we watched Guess Who's Coming to Dinner a couple of episodes back and really liked that. And Lilies in the Field, man, I was like, Sidney, God, he looks super cool. To start with, in his double denim look, and he's got so much charisma as well. He's got such a presence, and the film's basically lots of nuns fawning over Sidney's tools and his abilities, and he breaks down and outside of a monastery, and the head nun thinks he's been sent by God to help them out and build a new chapel. And you know, I quite liked this film.
I did too. I actually watched it last night.
I watched it two nights ago.
Oh, I caught that it was on this list. And did you know this is the movie he wins the Oscar for?
Yes, yeah.
And that was my big, like, is when he passed, I had seen In the Heat of the Night, I saw To Sir With Love when we did the 67 episode or whatever it was. And I guess he's coming to dinner. And I think I saw one more of his films. And I was like, none of those he has an Oscar for? Like, how does he not have an Oscar for In the Heat of the Night? So I was like, well, I have to watch this film at some point. And then I realized it was for 63. I'm like, well, I got to watch it tonight.
Sweet.
We're recording tomorrow. And I wasn't expecting a comedy because most of his other films, I mean, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner is comedic, but it's not. Like, it's not
at
all.
It's a heavy message, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And so, and he has so much gravitas. I kind of was surprised to see how lighthearted this was. Now, there are some serious moments, but even those are played. They're there just to kind of the bump along the road as he's like dealing with the stuff. This movie really had me like won over by the end. I was like into like all of the community building and people working together. I'm still shocked that like, cause again, like we were saying now comedic performances don't even get Oscar nominations usually.
No.
And he wins best actor for this and doesn't for In the Heat of the Night. I think he's even snubbed for In the Heat of the Night, if I remember correctly. I don't even think he's nominated for it.
I think he was there, yeah, because there was when he did sadly pass recently, as is the case a lot of the time, there's that kind of retrospective look back at a legendary performer's career, and generally kind of Oscar award snubs are something people look at, and I do believe that was one of them. But yeah, he's really good. I enjoyed this film more than I thought I would.
Same.
The Sword in the Stone that came out, Wolfgang Reitherman. I've seen that film when I was a kid. The animated film, From Russia with Love as well. The Bond film, Sean Connery. That's John's favourite genre of films is the Bond films. But no, I've seen that again. It's fine. It's Sean Connery doing his Sean Connery Bond thing. I watched a couple of the Ingmar Bergman films on this list. Winter Lights being one of them, which is. Having seen something like First Reformed, I kind of get where Paul Schrader's coming from on this film. But if Bergman's films are, they're existential cinema, you know, they're pieces of art, and they are not going to be for everyone, to be frank. But this film, I thought Winter Lights, I thought that was pretty good. I quite enjoyed Winter Light. I wasn't my favourite of the Bergman films. And The Silence, though, I thought that was a better film. Again, very bleak film. It's not, you're not dealing with anything particularly uplifting here, but I thought The Silence was a very good dramatic film from Ingmar Bergman. And I also watched the Jean-Luc Godard film Content, Brigitte Bardot, Jack Palance, Michel Piccoli. This was in French, but thankfully I can do this whole subtitle thing as well. And it's basically, it's Godard's look at his own marriage and his relationship with Hollywood. The film is a relationship which is falling apart whilst a film is being made. And it's, Brigitte Bardot, I think, is fabulous here. She is the producer of the film wanted, the producer said, we need nude shots of Brigitte Bardot. So there's a lot of lingering on her, usually her butt more than anything, nothing else. But the film isn't about that. Whilst her overt sexuality is on full display, like one of the most attractive women ever in cinema is on full display, her character isn't like that. Her character is the opposite of that. And that's what I liked. Jean-Luc Godard did that so well. And you've got the fabulous theme d'Acamille as well, which is a beautiful bit of music, which was in Casino. Martin Scorsese wanted to use it in that film as well when he did. But The Contempt was really good. And there's a couple of films on this list that we've both kind of had some crossover with. I'll let you take them. Only to say that The Birds, I really like The Birds. 8.5. Oh, yeah. I'm really interested to hear what you thought about 8.5, the Fellini film, because I saw that as well.
So, one I saw that was not originally on this list that I just kind of threw on here at the end was The Haunting with Robert, directed by Robert Weiss.
Any good?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's what made me finally watch The Haunting on Hill House because it's the same foundational story. And there's a 90s remake with Liam Neeson and the actress's name I'm going to forget, but she's in High Fidelity and stuff too. And Conjuring.
Crap. Sorry, you carry on. I'll find that name.
Yeah, but really like that movie. And I watched it actually, I forget. It was something I think tied to Robert Wise that made me watch it, but it was like, oh, it's 63 also. So I threw that on my list. I bought Contempt, but I haven't watched it yet. At some point I am going to check that out.
I liked that a lot.
The Birds, I'm a huge, it's such a nerdy thing to try to claim. Like, I'm a huge Hitchcock fan. Yes, he's a good filmmaker. I can't help it. But for a long time, I avoided old movies. So when I finally got into film, Hitchcock was one of the first older directors I dove into. Yeah. And I really, really found, like, how did I not just embrace these? And I've seen his films a lot because I teach them a lot. I love The Birds. I actually often refer to The Birds as like the proto zombie film because it comes out just a few years before Night of the Living Dead.
Good shot.
And the finale of that film is the finale of Night of the Living Dead, except instead of birds, it's zombies. But, yeah. 8.5. I knew literally nothing about this movie. I've seen the box. It's on all the lists. It's like 1,000 movies to see before you die kind of thing. Like it's always there. I didn't know what it was about. I didn't know it was going to be surreal, which they let you know pretty quickly into the movie.
It is surreal.
And I've never seen any Federico Fellini films. I've heard the name tons of times, but I didn't know where to start. This movie did make me add, my plan is in July, which is usually when we get the first of two Criterion discount sales, is I'm going to buy the Fellini box set on Criterion. It's like, wow. Right now it's $162, but it's like, it's a lot of movies. And I'm assuming it's usually half off, so I should be able to get it for like $85. Hopefully it'll still be around. But I do want to dive into his other movies because while I don't profess to fully understand what I saw,
I think that's the thing of his films, yeah.
But I see so much happening that I want to dive in and dissect it. Like there's obviously a debate about Catholicism and and communism in this movie that I'm like, okay, I don't fully grasp all of those concepts, but I'm interested to see why this is the battle. Obviously there's stuff with the Italian, involvement in World War II that he's working through. And I don't know I don't know enough about it to really understand what's being said about things. There's obviously a lot to do with filmmaking, and, or at the very least storytelling, as that's a big foundational thing. There's a lot with like commentary on love and how we treat relationships. And it's so, it explores things in such interesting ways. And yet it's a movie. Like it's not like this, it is avant-garde, but it doesn't feel inaccessible like some avant-garde films do. I think there's enough here that even someone who, as long as you're willing to accept the surreal flights of fancy that happen.
Oh, yeah.
I think there's a lot to take in with this movie, and I found it really, really compelling.
Yeah, this is called Fellini's masterpiece for most people. I've got, I'm looking and I've got La Dolce Vita over there on Blu-ray. Just see any one of his films I've got. And that's epic. I really like La Dolce Vita. And that's one that a lot of people would probably cite more if you ask film fans, maybe, you know, what's a Flora Fellini film they can think off the top of their head? They probably say La Dolce Vita. But 8.5 is, like you said, his films don't always lend themselves to particularly understanding what's happening. But, and I'm not always one for needing to rewatch a film to understand. However, I think you rewatch 8.5 and you strip a layer away and another one.
Yes.
And another, I think, and not that it becomes more obvious what's happening, but I think you become more and more absorbed in the journey. And it's an absolutely bonkers film. But it's fantastically good as well. It's the opening sequence in itself, like the dream sequence, is fantastic. It's fantastic. And like you say, if you don't know what the film's about, by the time you get into that opening sequence, by the time you're out of it, you know what you're in for. You might not understand what you're in for, but you know what you're getting, and you've got to buckle up. You might want to buckle up, baby. I think this is a fantastic meditative piece, which surprised me how good it was.
And the last movie on the list that I've seen, at least that I've seen as an adult and can remember seeing, is Jason and the Argonauts, which I taught several years ago. But after reading Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief, I needed a Greek mythology movie. And this one was well regarded. It has some of the cool visual effects, the skeleton soldiers.
It's all things,
claymation. Yes. Thank you, because I didn't know the name. I was like, I should have looked the name up. But it's an iconic film. It holds up. I think it's better. It's not better. I think Clash of the Titans, the 80s, is great. I actually think it's probably easier to watch in some ways. But I remember watching Jason and the Argonauts and really like being like, oh, wow, this is really cool. I really like the story. I also like Jason's story a lot, like of going for the Golden Fleece. And there's some movies on this list that I haven't seen, but I feel like I probably did, because my grandma loved Jerry Lewis, so I can't believe I've never seen The Nutty Professor. I remember Eddie Murphy's Nutty Professor much more.
Same with Flipper. I haven't seen the Clark directed one, but I've seen the 90s version.
And I've definitely seen the TV series Flipper at some point.
And the Pink Panther.
Same. I feel like I've seen them, but not in a way that I can like. My grandpa definitely liked Pink Panther when I was a kid. I remember it being on. I remember being confused because I knew the cartoon cat who is connected to the intro.
Exactly.
But nothing to do with anything else. So like,
I've seen those films, but I remember Niven and Sellers. And I'm like you, the first time I realized there's a film. And then, of course, I think there's a Steve Martin one as well. But as a kid, I was like, where's the Pink Panther? Where's the panther that's pink? This isn't him. You're not Ron. Who's this guy?
And I don't think I really watched them. And if I did, I was a kid. I have not gone to them as an adult to watch them. So I can't claim them, but those are some beloved movies. Again, a lot of comedies that people, cite for this year. But there's some good movies on here, but not as many as we often get with the notable releases. A lot of times there's more on the notable releases that we've seen than in the top 10. And that is not the case here, but only because we attacked the top 10 this time. We're like, we're getting all of these in.
And there are films on here that I haven't seen, but they've got big stars, and Judy Garland stars in I Could Go On Singing. Hud, what a great name that came out. Probably going to hear a bit more about that in a minute. But you've got Peter Finch, Jane Fonda, Angela Lansbury, Arthur Hill. They starred in The Cool of the Day. Big name stars, but I haven't. I just haven't seen those films, so maybe they'll go on the gap list. But some interesting films coming out, and some ones which you've definitely heard of, and some which you may hear more about in our next segment.
Award season.
So these are the Academy Award winners. There's no Razzies in 1963, so this is just going to be the positive awards. We like to take a look at the big categories, who won, who didn't. So Best Picture. Drum roll, please. Tom Jones wins Best Picture. Matt, I'm going to have to hear it if you think that's worthy Best Picture or not.
No.
Oh,
no. I don't.
And then
surprises me, because Best Director, Tony Richardson for Tom Jones.
I'm a little disappointed that it's not the singer Tom Jones who directed the movie Tom Jones.
It's not unusual.
You know, what's new, Pussycat? Best Actor goes... I spoiled this. I apologize. Sidney Poitier for Lilies of the Field. I wasn't even thinking about it when I said
that was worth spoiling, though, my friend, because again, the great man passed recently and he is very good in that film. So sometimes it's hard to talk about the film and then not mention that they've won the award for it. Sometimes you just have to get it out there, my friend. Best actress went to Patricia Neal for Hud.
Best supporting actor goes to Melvin Douglas for Hud.
Best supporting actress, Margaret Rutherford for The VIPs.
Best original screenplay, How the West Was Won.
Best adapted screenplay, Tom Jones.
And best original score, as Matt and I just sang to everybody, John Addison for Tom Jones. Right? That's the songs we sang are in the movie, right?
Yeah, no? Of course, yeah. Okay. What else did he sing? Delilah, Sex Bomb. That Sex Bomb probably would have fit, actually. Best original song was Call Me Irresponsible, which is from Papa's Delicate Condition.
And best cinematography is a tie? Oh, no, they had a black and white and a color category. Interesting. Yes, HUD for black and white, and color, Cleopatra, of course, because that movie does look gorgeous. I did watch the clip of her entrance, and I'm like, wow, that is insane.
That's practical. I know it's clear, obvious, but that's practical. And he just we watched, what did we watch like recently, like Death on the Nile and that, and it's all set against the volume or the green screen, blue screen. And you think, I mean, even back in the 60s, they were pulling this off. And it looked, they had no choice. And that kind of practical filmmaking will always win out. It looks stunning. So best cinematography, I'm not surprised that Cleopatra walked away from that. I bet 20th Century Fox expected Cleopatra to walk away with more awards, especially the top one, best picture. Tom Jones, Baz, best picture. It's fawned upon by a lot of people. A lot of people seem to really like Tom Jones. I just could not get into this film. I tried. Like I said, I think Albert Finney's really very good. But for best picture, I mean, I could think of a few in the top 10 that I would have put above it. I mean, I would probably put Cleopatra above it in terms of, was it a better film overall? Yeah, it was. How the West Was Won was probably a better film overall. Hey, Charade was a better film overall than Tom. And I don't want to sound like I'm needlessly hating on this film, because there are elements of it I didn't mind. But when I saw how much love it was getting, I was like, oh, this could be one of those films where you go in not expecting much and it's actually great. But it just didn't work for me, my friend. But HUD, neither of us saw HUD, but it looks like there's some good performances in there, dude.
Yeah, I don't know.
And Tom Jones, best screenplay, best score. The score, I don't know, I thought the score for Tom Jones actually took me out of the film even more, my friend.
Man.
And again, I don't want to sound like I'm hating on this film, but I don't think it's a great score either. But well, let's have a look then at the top 10 themselves and what they did win. We mentioned Cleopatra. That did win some awards. It won cinematography for colour, obviously. It also won best art direction and set direction in the colour category, best costume design in the colour category, and best effects, special visual effects, which absolutely should have done. But it was nominated for best picture, best actor, best sound, best film editing, best music score, substantially original. It's interesting to note that it wasn't that Elizabeth Taylor wasn't at all nominated for best actress, but it did get a best actor nom.
It is worthy to note, too, that if it were this year's Oscars, that none of its awards would have even been televised, I think, maybe.
You're right.
It got a lot of those awards. It was nominated for all those big ones, but it got none. How the West Was Won, it did win. It won best original screenplay, best sound, best film editing, but it was nominated for, again, best picture, best cinematography, color, best art direction, set direction, color, best costume design, best music score, substantially original. That's interesting.
I know, it's funny that. I guess it's they should have that nowadays, because some of the scores are fantastic, but because like the score for The Hateful Eight, could it be recognized by the Academy because it contains some of Morricone's old stuff? I'm not sure if it could.
That's interesting.
They should, they should keep that in mind. But It's a Mad, 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 Mad World won the Academy Award for Best Effects, Sound Effects. But it was nominated for Best Cinematography, Color, Best Sound, Best Film Editing, Best Music Original Song, and Best Music Score that was substantially original. So top three so far, dude. They kind of swept the board at nominations, at least, apart from Best Director.
Well, and here comes Tom Jones, a movie that I definitely wouldn't have, if you had shown me the top 10, I would not have guessed that Tom Jones would have been the best picture winner on that list, because it's a movie I really hadn't heard much about. I will have to watch now, because I'm trying to get through all the best picture winners at some point. So it won best picture, as we said, best director, best adapted screenplay, best musical score, again, substantially original. It had a best actor nomination, as well as three supporting actress nominations and a best supporting actor nom. So it had a lot of the noms, but not one winner. That's kind of wild when you think about it. Best art direction set for Color.
Yeah, it was a beloved film that year. I'm looking forward to hearing your thoughts on it when you do finally get to watch it, though, my friend. Hey, look, you may love it, but I'm not sure if it will be your cup of tea either, but stranger things have happened. Emma LaDuce, it won Best Music, Best Scoring of Music, Adaptation or Treatment. So that walked towards the top five, or won at least one Oscar. And Emma LaDuce was nominated for Best Actress for Shirley MacLaine and Best Colour Cinematography.
And then, I think just to kind of wrap this up, the other five, nothing won. Like, so that's the first five. There's a winner in every one won something. And then the last five, so 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, or I guess 9, 9, because there's a tie there, didn't win anything. However, a few were nominated.
Yeah.
Just knock these out.
Yeah, Sherrod nominated for Best Original Song.
Bye Bye Birdie, Best Music Score for Adaptation, and Best Sound.
Come Blow Your Horn, John's favorite title, was nominated for Best Art Direction, Set Direction.
No horn nomination. What's the deal, Oscars? And then Great Escape, just Best Film Editing. Can you believe that's the only thing that movie's nominated for?
No, I can't. To be
that's
honest,
wild.
No. They're wild. I thought, I think it looked good. I think it sounded good. I think
the performance, man, McQueen. Like, how McQueen. Do you not give him a nod for that? Like, it's wild.
Yeah, and it's odd to notice that there was, I don't think any of the, apart from Tom Jones, obviously, none of the other films got a Best Director nod. So it'd be interesting to know who the directors were. I may have a little look at that shortly. But you mentioned there that Tom Jones wouldn't have been your best picture when out of the films that you saw then, what would have been your best picture?
I think just based on, again, I didn't see Cleopatra or How the West Was Won, right? But of what we saw, I can't believe The Great Escape wasn't nominated. Like, in my head, that's a nominee, right? Like, I'd like Birds, but like, I understand that that's probably not going to get Oscar love because it's a horror movie, and that's not. I just learned that Hitchcock had no directing noms.
I think like, he was, the Nolan, that's why the Nolan comparisons were quite apt for the longest time because of the no director's nod.
I'm like baffled at that because Hitchcock is like, in my eyes, the director. And it's like, wait, what? He's literally the term auteur is because of Truffaut giving it to Hitchcock. And he's never won. Like, it's insane to me. Again, it's just a point that Oscars do not inherently mean quality, but
yeah,
but we do expect the things that we think are great to have won. And when they don't, it's shocking.
Well, best picture, the nominations were, America, America, Cleopatra, How the West Was Won, and Lilies of the Field. So they were the noms. Best director. Obviously, Tony Richardson won for Tom Jones. The nominees were Martin Ritt for Hud, Otto Preminger for The Cardinal, Elia Kazan for America, America, which isn't a film we mentioned at all, and nope. Federico Fellini got a nomination for 8.5 for one. So that makes sense.
And that's impressive, actually, because the Oscars have not always been good at nominating international directors. So
no, you're
that's
right.
Actually,
out of those five, I've only seen two of the films, but I would say 8.5 is a better directed film. Again, nothing against Tom Jones. 8.5
is
he directed.
A director's movie, though, like you can see his imprint all over it. It's literally about a director. Like it's there.
Yeah, it's that would be the pick for me for best director. And hey, look, if I'm really being out there, for me, it's probably possibly the best film of that year. Again, technically and all around, I think it's incredibly well made. Was it the most enjoyable? Maybe not in terms of, I think like The Birds, I could sit down and watch that more often, but 8.5 was a fabulous, fabulous film, my friend. So, but that was the awards then, JB, a couple of surprises, some films, maybe not so much, and a couple of nice wins there, especially for Sidney Poitier. So let's move on to our next segment, my friend.
Births and deaths.
Yes, so our next segment, we talk about the talent who you've seen on your screens, who came into the world, and those who sadly left us. So, John, let's start with the births.
So, January 14th, Steven Soderbergh is born. His new movie, Kimmy, is on HBO Max right now. Check it out.
Go check it out. February 21st, William Baldwin was born. He's the other Baldwin. He was in Flatliners and Backdraft.
Is he the middle Baldwin?
I think so.
March 20th, we get David Thewlis, most known, in my eyes, from Harry Potter.
As is most English actors now, or British actors nowadays.
Yeah,
sure. You may have heard of this one, John. March 27th, Quentin Tarantino. He's a director. He's directed some films you might have heard of. I think Quentin Tarantino, his latter films are better than his earlier films.
Crazy to think he's about to be 60.
Yeah.
He's 59 this year. His birthday is coming up. April 26th, we get Jet Li. Wow, that is insane to me that Jet Li and Quentin Tarantino are the same. They don't look like they're the same. But Jet Li, great, great martial arts actor. Done some amazing movies. Hero, one of my favorites.
Here's one we know and love. May 25th, Mike Myers was born. Austin Powers, Wayne's World, Shrek, so many other cool comedies, and some absolute stinkers too.
We're truly not worthy. June 6th, we get Jason Isaacs, another Harry Potter alum.
I think we're going to get good. And these older years, I think we're going to get quite a few. June the 9th, Johnny Depp is born. Obviously, Fantastic Beasts. Most known, I think, nowadays to most people is Jack Sparrow in Pirates of the Caribbean. But he's done so many iconic roles.
Big time. June 15th, tornado catcher Helen Hunt.
June 17th, Greg Kinnear is born.
They both think as good as it gets. July 2nd, Mark Kermode, film critic.
Yes, who I met that one time and had to show the way out of the cinema. July the 15th, Bridget Nielsen, a wonderful actress from Red Sonja, Rocky IV, Beverly Hills Cop 2, and more.
July 16th, Phoebe Cates, Gremlins, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, and Drop Dead Fred, a beloved movie of my childhood.
Yes, I think it gets mentioned again a few more times. July 27th, Donnie Yen, Ip Man, Rogue One, Mulan, fabulous, again, in fact, great actor, great martial artist.
Still, at his age, mind you, it's insane. July 30th, Lisa Kudrow, it needs no introduction, guys, she's Phoebe. Yeah.
She'll be there for you. August the 1st, Damien Bashir, Damien Bashir's been in a lot of films in the background, and he's a very good character actor, supporting actor.
And August 1st as well, John Carroll Lynch, the man who's infamously cast as a serial killer all the time, poor guy.
Walking spoiler.
He walks into a room, it's like, hey, we have a serial killer role for you. It's poor guy.
I never forget the first time I watched Zodiac and he walked in. I was like, oh, for God's sake.
I know.
It's a John Carroll Lynch. Come on. August the 5th, Mark Strong was born. Great Scottish actor, most recently in Shazam, Cruella, and the Kingsman films.
October 6th, Elizabeth Shue, most famous for The Karate Kid, in my opinion, but Adventures in Babysitting as well, of course. And Back to the Future 2 and 3, where she's recast.
Yes, she is, yeah. October 31st, Rob Schneider, Deuce Bigelow himself, was born.
November 5th, Tatum O'Neill, Paper Moon, no big deal.
Yeah, she's the youngest person ever to win a competitive Academy Award. November 20th, Ming-Na Wen was born, most recently in The Book of Boba Fett and The Mandalorian, but obviously she's the voice of Mulan, she's in Street Fighter, Final Fantasy, The Spirits of Within. I love Ming-Na Wen.
Yeah, especially on that. She's easily my favorite part of the Book of Boba Fett. December 16th, Benjamin Bratt. Demolition Man. I like him in Demolition Man, actually. Law and Order, Miss Congeniality, and, of course, Halle Berry's Catwoman.
Yeah, I was hoping you'd say that. And again, and saving possibly one of the best until last, December the 18th, Brad Pitt was born, Oscar winner for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And he's, again, an actor, chameleon of an actor who's been in so many great films. Like 12 Monkeys, 7, Curious Case of Benjamin Button, then going to the Ocean films, Troy. You know, so many good films this dude's been in. Still, I think, underrated as an actor, even with the Oscar win.
Agreed. Have you seen the trailer for Bullet Train?
Yeah, that looks fun.
It looks very fun. It's David Leitch, so I'm in for that reason, too. But yeah,
Joey King as well. He is hoping.
Maybe it's time. Sorry, Joey. We've given you so many chances. I'm tired of kissing booths.
Yes.
So those are the bursts. Those are who joined us in 1963. Many big names, huge names. I also, would you have thought Tarantino and Brad Pitt were born the same year?
No, absolutely like, not. Old Mark Myers as well. Like they're 60s, not old, but you don't.
Yeah.
I always see them as made up from 45, maybe 50.
But they don't seem like contemporaries even. Like when you look at Brad Pitt and you look at Tarantino, like one looks like they've lived 60 years. One looks like he's not. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
No offense to Tarantino, but like really.
There is an aging difference. So yeah.
Yeah. And then when I'm like, I'm 40, like I'm only 23 years younger than them. And I'm like,
you can't all age as gracefully as you, my friend.
Oh, you know, I try. I guess not 23, 22 years. I'm rounding up for some reason, but we also lost some people, as you noted. We lost on January 2nd of 1963. We lost Jack Carson at age 52, most known for Cat on a Hot Tin Roof as an actor.
Yeah. January 28th, John Farrow passed away, age 58. He was a director, Academy Award winning director for Around the World in 80 Days.
On November 29th, so we jump almost to the end of the year, we lose Charles Schnee, age 47, so young, screenwriter. Most notable for The Bad and the Beautiful, which apparently won an Oscar.
He did. That. He won the award for that, yep. And finally, December the 5th, Tom London, 74-year-old actor, best known for his performances in Calamity Jane and High Noon. And according to the Guinness Book of Movie Records, he's credited with appearing in the most credited films. Apparently, he's got 2,000 appearances. Apparently.
Wow. Thank you, studio system, for abusing the crap out of your actors. Good Lord.
His first appearance was The Great Train Robbery in 1903, and he made over 2,000, apparently. So how about that?
That's insane. If you guys haven't seen it's a short because the original films were only like the reel of a film, so 10 minutes or so. Great Train Robbery, definitely worth checking out. It's usually on YouTube. It's one of the first POVs that the shot has been mirrored all the time, where you're looking at the barrel of the gun. Scared people, so yeah, worth watching for film history's sake.
Yeah, that's film school 101 for me. That is you showed them that. So that was some of the talent who joined us and sadly who left us in 1963. Let's move on to our next segment to find out a little bit more about the talent that we've grown to know and love.
Debuts.
Like it said, these are actors or directors or whatever who make their first appearance in 1963.
Yeah, Alan Alda. His first appearance was in Gone Are the Days, and since went on to obviously star in MASH, the TV series, 30 Rock, The West Wing, The Aviator, and Marriage Story recently too. James Brolin appeared in Take Hershey's Mine and has been in Traffic, Westworld ever since. Mel Brooks. His first appearance was in The Critics. He's gone on to win the Oscar for The Producers. And then what else has he done? Blazing Saddles, Young Frankenstein, Robin Hood, Men in Tights, Spaceballs. How many more can you list off from the legendary Mel Brooks?
Both directs and acts in most of those films. Not usually the star, but usually in there somewhere.
No, double-edged sword or double-headed sword, that man, if that's even a thing. James Caan, his first appearance was in Irma La Douce. And he's gone on to appear in The Godfather, A Bridge Too Far. Obviously, he peaked in Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 1 and 2. Elf, Misery as well. Of course, Misery. How can we forget Misery with that? Oh, that bed scene. Ooh. Well, the bed leg scene. Dick Van Dyke first appeared in Bye Bye Birdie. Obviously, well known for Mary Poppins, The Dick Van Dyke Show, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, Dick Tracy, and so many more. Peter Fonda as well, first appearance. Tammy and the Doctor, and he went on to star in Easy Rider and the fabulous 3:10 to Yuma.
And then Clint Howard shows up in The Courtship of Eddie's Father, would be in The Waterboy, Apollo 13, The Cowboys TV show, My Name is Earl TV show, and every Ron Howard film. Yes, it is Clint Howard. What's the ice cream horror movie? He's an ice cream man. It's like he's the lead. I can't think of what it's called, but we also get Christopher Lambert. I used to always say Lambert, but I've recently heard Lambert, so I'm not sure which one's right. The movie that he debuts in is Who's Mining the Store, most known for the Highlander series, and he's Raiden in the original Mortal Kombat film, which is better than last year's HBO Max release. And he's in some other things, Legend of Tarzan, Lord of the Apes, blah, blah, blah. Highlander's really the movie, right? That's where we know the guy.
Of course, yeah.
There can be only one. Estelle Parsons, Ladybug, Ladybug is her debut, but then most famously for Bonnie and Clyde, Rachel, Rachel, Roseanne, the TV series, and the Connors. Is she the mom in that, I guess, in Roseanne?
I don't know.
I
think she
older,
would be, yeah.
So. Kurt Russell.
Yeah.
We know Kurt Russell. He debuts in It Happened at the World's Fair, where he is kind of lumped into Disney movies for a long time, but then breaks out with some movies you may have heard of, The Thing. He's actually in Carpenter's Elvis TV movie as Elvis in the 70s before he does The Thing. But we get Big Trouble in Little China, one of my favorite action movies of all time. Escape from New York, Escape from LA. I mean, the dude's career is legendary. He's one of my favorite actors. Love, love, love Kurt Russell. So great that he debuts here. And then, oddly, because, man, I didn't realize how late Sutherland must have started, but Donald Sutherland debuts the same year. The World 10 Times Over is his debut, but then obviously he's in MASH and Kelly's Heroes. Clute, my favorite version of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I love the 70s version. I like the 50s version, but I love the 70s version. And of course, he's in that amazing movie series, The Hunger Games.
What I don't mind those first few films.
The first one's solid, man, but it gets progressively worse. Andre Tarkovsky,
Tarkovsky.
I know that name too. That's sad. Ivan's Childhood is the debut. Most known for Solaris. I'm assuming not the Soderbergh one. Stalker, Nostalgia, The Sacrifice, and Andrei Rublev.
It's bonkers to me to see that Kurt Russell and Dick Van Dyke debuted in the same year.
Yes.
It doesn't seem right.
Russell is a kid, to be fair, because he's doing Disney movies.
Kurt Russell is very much a kid. Dick Van Dyke isn't. But, every time you mention Kurt Russell appearing in those Disney films, it's like Fred McMurray, but different. Whereas he went on to do, what did Fred McMurray do? Double Indemnity to kind of break out of Disney, but then kind of fell back into it. Kurt Russell never looked back. Yeah, we got the Christmas Chronicles, which we all love. But Kurt Russell,
being Kurt Russell in that. Like, he's Kurt Russell Santa. He's not Santa.
Kurt Russell is one of the coolest men ever to grace the earth.
That's, I think. It's literally like he walked into the pitch room and was like, hey, what if Santa, but it's cool? Me. And you're like, okay, let's do that. Let's do that. I want a scene of you in jail playing rock guitar. Let's make that happen. I'll never forget that scene.
I just want to imagine that he was just out and about in LA wearing a red jacket one day, and the producer was like, hold on. Yep. This Kurt Russell Santa, that works for me. But some big names there, though, my friend, some legendary names, some which are still going very strong now, which is fabulous to see. So always enjoy. And a couple of Oscar winners there as well, Estelle Parsons and Mel Brooks. So always enjoy seeing who made their beginnings, who made their origins in the year that we're discussing. But we're here for films. We're here to find out the top 10 of the year, you know, some of the best films, the legendary people who left their mark on film. But we are only here for one reason, my friend.
The horoscope.
I have consulted the stars. And it has become apparent that the year of 1963 is the year of the Sphinx. Beware the all-seeing eye, but don't be afraid to ask the questions. Like how to win over this mad, 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 mad world of ours. Or what's new, pussycat? It's easy to try and be something you're not sometimes, but being true to oneself is the best way to live. Embrace the true you and escape the prison of expectations and unreasonable standards.
All on the mic. He doesn't research. He comes out with that just here and now. He's consulted with the stars. When he got to the mad, mad, mad world, but I was like, this is popping, John.
You know, sometimes the stars speak and I just have to listen.
Yeah. I say this every month or every episode. Sorry. Don't break illusion. That one day we will have when astrology was all said and done, after I don't know how many episodes it ended up being, 60, 70, I don't know, we'll compile the Berkoscopes and we'll see the evolution from episode one to episode the last one, and we can all revel in that moment.
I'm always so afraid that I will repeat what the year of is, because like I don't remember what the other ones have been. So I'm like, I hope I haven't used Sphinx before, but we're gonna go with it.
I can't imagine you have that use that particular one.
Yeah, I feel like that one was pretty safe. Had I gone Year of the Cat, which was my first like guttural stars telling me to go with, but no, too much behind the scenes, folks. That's a wrap.
John did text me then, does Cleopatra have a cat? Like, yeah. Well, she did actually have a cat, yes. And she was, and the Sphinx, I think, was what she was known for. I had to Google it. I was like, if I say that and you use it and it's wrong, we're going to sound like idiots. So it is a Sphinx. But so that's, yeah, the Berkoscope was the perfect way to end off the year. Now, as we always do, we always kind of just give our quick reflections on the year. We've mentioned what we thought of the top 10. But overall then, as a year in film, to you, what did you think, John, and comparatively to the other kind of 20 episodes we've done, where is this ranking for you, roughly?
It's a little low. It's not a bad year by any means. I don't think the movies that we saw were inherently bad, but I also don't feel like there is this like big pop-out thing, except you have 8.5, you have The Birds. Those are two huge films, but even in Hitchcock's repertoire, that's not one of his... It's one that's always included in like the big box sets because it's such an iconic film, but I think you're not going to throw that as like his best, right? Like, yeah. It's a really cool horror film, but you're going to go Psycho or Rear Window or Vertigo or Notorious way before you go Birds. So I don't feel like there's like a movie that shines as this like icon of the year that some other years have where it's like, oh, well, there's the best movie. Because like we're saying, the Best Picture winner feels lackluster. The Great Escape is right up there. It's the closest thing I think we have to that big movie. But for me, it never felt like that type of movie. It sounds like for you, it might have been. But here, like I was aware of it, but it wasn't ever present like some of the other years we've had so far.
Yeah, no, it's a big film only because it's been present just like growing up. It's just always on television in, you know, at the best time of year, the holiday season. But if you'd asked me what year it came out, I would have thought, I don't know, 69 maybe, I don't know. When I spoke to my dad before earlier on, I said what we're doing. I said what I was doing tonight. I said, oh, I'm just, you know, we're talking about this year in film. He's like, oh, don't think I know any films that came out that year. And I said, oh, you will do. But that kind of struck me. It's like, how memorable of a year is it? Because I said, oh, you know, Cleopatra, Howard West is one. Well, The Great Escape, you love that film. It's like, oh, of course. So when you tell people what came out, they've heard of them. But like you say, nothing is there. Like, not every year has, not every year, you're not going to like, what was the big film in 1964? I don't know. I might know if I looked, but some years are defined, aren't they, by some of the releases.
And well, some years there's not anything else going on. When you look at the history of 1963, like the JFK assassination alone, it's going to overshadow almost everything else that happened because there's so much happening. It's hard to think like, oh, remember 1963? Remember this movie? It's like JFK died. What are you talking about? Why are you talking about
the happened this year?
Yeah. Like there's big real life things happening. Movies are an afterthought. And I think that's kind of maybe reflective of the culture and why, while there's good stuff here, why it's not a year that we really think of as like a cinema, like 1999, there's like the biggest problem we had in 1999 was that the world might end at the end of it because we thought Y2K was the thing. But that year in cinema is so epic.
What a way to go out that would have been.
Yeah, right. It was like everything was in a positive vibe where like in 63, there was a shift happening. And so there was tension. And that's, I think what we're going to see with the years 2020, 2021, 2022, maybe no one's talking about the movies, no matter how impactful they might be culturally. Because our world is like deteriorating in front of us. We're like watching people tear each other apart or a virus ripped us apart. Now Russia's invading, so we don't know what's happening next. Like, I think that might be what happened to 63. It's just like, even if the movies were great, real world overshadowed it in big ways, both in positive, like the I Have a Dream speech, or in negative because of the JFK assassination. Like, it's,
that's a good shout. Yeah. I mean, I'd love to hear from somebody who was of a movie going age in 63 because. Yeah. I mean, I'm looking at some of the films that came out in the last few years and even like Ghostbusters or whatever, or even Spider-Man Nowhere, we've said, you know, these are the films we need right now, you know, it's just to get out and forget the troubles. Maybe some of these films in 63, maybe like something like a Cleopatra or these comedies, like you mentioned in the top 10, maybe people were rushing out to see these films because they needed that escapism. However, in subsequent years, none of these really broke out into the zeitgeist. There are, of course, most of these films people have probably heard of, But I mean, if you went down the street and said to someone, you know, what do you think of Bye Bye Birdie, for example, they think, why? What's that? But having watched the film, you know, it's fine. Or Move Over, Darling, it's fine. It's a totally serviceable, confident comedy film. But it's not, you know, it's not a breakout comedy film. And I mean, Cleopatra, How the West Was Won, and The Great Escape are the big three of the year for me. I know Tom Jones was the Best Picture winner, but I think those films are the ones that have, and The Birds, obviously, they're the ones that have had that legacy for longer. I suppose you could throw Jason and the Argonauts for the iconic kind of Harryhausen, Ray Harryhausen. I get the damn words out.
I'm like, wow, you said it fine earlier.
For some reason I thought his name was Harry, and I was like, his name's not Harry Harryhausen, it's Ray. But yeah, I think this was a decent year in film, but it's not one which there's not many films in this year which I will think, you know what, I'm going to revisit that one. I'm definitely going to revisit. There's not too many of them, and certainly not many in the top 10, but it was a fine year in film, my friend.
Exactly. Yeah, it's not a bad year, but just not the iconic years that we've maybe covered or will be covering here soon.
Yep, and we did 1967, which is a few years later, and I think we were both pretty high on that year. So
yeah, super crazy good year.
Exactly. So it's not, we're not just here for the 90s or the 80s and onwards. We're here for everything. It's just, this one was fine. But that is going to wrap up our episode of Movie Astrology covering 1963. We hope you all enjoyed what you've just heard. If you did enjoy it, you can follow the show. Just search Movie Astrology on Twitter and Instagram. You'll find the show there. Give us a follow. We always drop stills from the episodes, and you might see our faces on some familiar film stars every time we drop an episode. But yeah, Movie Astrology on the socials. If you want to find me, you can do whatiwatchtonight.co.uk, What I Watch Tonight across the socials and Letterboxd, and you can find John at
BurkeReviews.com and at BurkeReviews on all the social media platforms.
Go check them out. You can check us out weekly on the Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast, where we discuss the biggest film release of the week. So check that out as well. And if you like the movie astrology offerings that you get, please do consider leaving us a 5-star rating or review on your podcast provider of choice. It helps the show out. It gets more film lovers into the show as well. And we just enjoy hearing from you guys as much as possible. So thank you so much, everyone, for listening. From me, I'm going to say see ya. And from John,
keep watching movies.